Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our week in review. And it was a week that challenged us to our core about safety, accountability, and our collective resilience. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh talked resilience in what is likely his final State of the City address as he prepares to head to Washington.
I want to thank every single resident in Boston for keeping your family safe, helping your neighbors, and moving our city forward. And I want to say to you tonight, we may be hurting, but the state of our city is resilient, the state of our city is united, the state of our city is hopeful, and the state of our city is deep down Boston strong.
And if Boston is strong, our experiment in democracy is shaken. After a historic second impeachment of President Trump following an armed insurrection at the Capitol, Massachusetts Congressman and former Marine Seth Moulton worries about safety at the inauguration.
I don't feel completely safe. We've received intelligence briefings about the various extremist groups, domestic terror organizations that have very specific plots against inauguration, against the president, against members of Congress. The security threat is very real.
Massachusetts is sending some 500 National Guard troops for next week's events. And Governor Baker says the ever-present pandemic makes a peaceful transition of power even more essential.
We really need this transition to be as clean and as coordinated as possible, especially around all these issues that are associated with COVID.
Meanwhile, that pandemic is nowhere near done with us, as Massachusetts passes 13,000 deaths and lags behind other states in our vaccine rollout. Let's start there with the status of the coronavirus pandemic here at home. Do you feel more or less safe from the pandemic than you did last spring? How can we stay resilient with our economy, our relationships, as the pandemic continues? And what accountability do you want? From whom? Around vaccines, the spread? Call, join us. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's welcome our panelists now. We have Wilnelia Rivera, a Democratic strategist, founder of Rivera Consulting, and chief strategist for Representative Ayanna Pressley's successful 2018 congressional campaign. And we have Richard Tessay, who is a former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress. Wilnelia, Richard, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have been so caught up in political events that it's drawn our eyes away, at least in part, from this staggering march forward of the virus. How have you been thinking about it? Has it been on your mind this week, Richard, the fact that these cases are still surging, or has your attention been elsewhere?
No, I've been I get alerts from the state, you know, saying that we're in the red zone. So, I mean, it's kind of hard to forget where we are right now and, you know, where we are in the whole process. I want to say, though, that, you know, there is light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, we are in a, nobody thought that it was near impossible to get a vaccine developed as quickly as we have. We have two, maybe three now. And, you know, so we are at the end of the tunnel. It's just, you know, getting through the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks to get, you know, the people who really need to be vaccinated. So we could be in a lot, you know, there's a silver lining. It could be a lot worse.
Well, Nelia, is that where you are? Are you feeling like you're in the point where, rather than feeling overwhelmed, you feel like you're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel?
I wish I could see the light. I try not to look at these problems within a tunnel. I think it's better for all of our collective mental health not to look at it that way. But to build off of what Richard said, I do think that, you know, with the incoming, you know, sort of federal administration, hopefully we begin to have an actual national federal response. States like Massachusetts have been left on our own to really sort of tackle this problem. And the reality that COVID has demonstrated in this rollout has demonstrated is that this is a scale of public health coordination that as a state we haven't been fully prepared for. I think we're doing the best that we can with the infrastructure that we have and with the vaccines that we do have available to us. But what's clear is that the national coordination that's needed for that hopefully will be coming with this next administration. And that's where I lie my optimism in. Where and how will this administration be able to support states like Massachusetts so that we can reach the scale that we need to make sure that we get everybody vaccinated over the course of the next year?
Let's go straight to our first call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to give us your thoughts on where we are with the pandemic right now. We've got Tom on the line from Acton. Tom, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, my name is Tom Scafferato. I'm actually from Acton, Massachusetts. I'm a general surgeon over at Haywood Hospital in Gardner. I'm actually the chief of surgery out there. And I was lucky enough to receive the Pfizer vaccine shot with great results. But, you know, it's been a journey with as a healthcare provider, and wanted to thank everybody for everybody's hard work in this. You know, as personally, I have two young kids, and it is tougher nowadays, I think, than it was in the spring. We do know more than we did before in the past, but I think it's just a lot more challenging with the volume that we're seeing in the hospital. And I'll take
and
my
Tom, are
off
you
air.
Wait before oh, you go, sorry. Tom, are you fully vaccinated? Have you received both Pfizer doses at this point?
I have, yes. I'm about 7 days out from the second dose.
All right. Thanks for the
and
call, Tom, and be
effect.
Well.
Yeah.
Good. Thank Good you. To hear. Be well. And that feels important to hear, the zero mm-hmm. side effects, to continue to encourage people to take the vaccine, to understand that it's safe. I will pick up more on vaccines in a minute, but I'm also zeroing in on Tom's answer saying somehow we do feel less safe now than in the spring. Just a couple of numbers. We are past 13,000 fatalities in the Commonwealth. We're approaching 2 million worldwide. Non-surge ICU beds in Boston are stretched to the breaking point. And our 7-day averages, the close of last week, it was above 5,000 cases, 7-day average, above 70 deaths per day. Richard, we hear so much about this being community spread, neighbor to neighbor, inside a household, small family gatherings. You know, I wonder what we need to do to get to the point where we're fully doing what we can to take care of each other.
Well, I mean, the state's made a remarkable effort right now to keep people, you know, to provide information, look at what's going on in the business community right now, small businesses throughout the state. You know, shuttered, you know, so there's been a lot that's been done. You know, I think the virus at the end of the day is going to be the virus, and, you know, it's very hard to completely contain it. I think that right now the most important thing, you know, is to get people vaccinated. It isn't, you know, that they're getting one shot, as the doctor just mentioned. He has another shot, so each person, you know, is getting two vaccinations. You have the vaccine itself that only has a 6-hour shelf life, so you do have to plan out who's going to be getting it and make sure everybody shows up to get it. You know, you have to make sure that those people are socially distanced, that they have that they're under observation for 15 minutes after, and then you have to again have the second shot. So it's a, you know, logistically, it's a lot of work, and you're not talking, you know, and actually I want to say what has been surprising to me is that of the people who have been qualified or are on the list to get the shot, how many have declined it? You know, I think you're looking at, you know, about 35% of the people who are eligible to get it, you know, that aren't getting it. And that creates a whole problem in and of itself.
So I hadn't seen those numbers, Richard. Well, Nellie, it sounds like you want to jump in there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, what's important about the stage in the intersection that we're in this particular crisis is that we need to recognize the amount of women and manpower it's going to take to get us out of this. And the reason I say that is that I think we've been focusing a lot on the role of state government, municipal government, the federal government, right? But there's also the workforce itself. How are we going to actually administer all these vaccinations once we're actually moving into the general population? Because it's one thing to vaccinate folks that are on the vulnerability list by criteria, by age or morbidity, or because they're a frontline worker. But what are we actually going to do to get to those folks that for some reason or another, some, you know, many legitimate, or why they don't have the trust in the vaccination to even be taking that. Because I think one of the biggest problems we're going to have over time is how do we actually reach that 70% vaccination rate that we know we need as a country to really actually fend this off over time so that we're not just living and accepting the fact that this virus is with us. How do we get to a point over time, not just this calendar year, where we see this as a common cold? Obviously, we're very far from what that takes. And it's not going to be more, it's going to be more than just a vaccination. How does mobility need to look differently? How do our schools need to be, our infrastructures for our school need to look differently? For sort of lack of better words, and I think for all of the listeners, this is an all hands on deck moment for our country. COVID has revealed a lot, and vaccination is one thing that's going to get us there. But we have to wholesale look at what is it that we're investing in, and why. What is it that's important to us as a country and as a state in this moment? Because it's going to be much more than just vaccinations and much more than just getting some kids back to school.
I'm going to go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. We've got Rachel on the line in Everett. Rachel, go ahead.
Hi. So I just wanted to say I'm definitely still on high alert, and I don't feel like things are rounding a corner just because of personal recent experience where a direct contact of my husband's, who works with him, went and tested positive for COVID and went to work and didn't tell anyone. So we were exposed. And also, just to add to that, it makes me sad, and this is really my point, that we live in a society where people don't feel like they can say to their employer, hey, I'm sick, I need to take time off, and I tested positive for COVID, and they feel the need to go to work while sick so they can provide for their families. And I feel like that's a really sad system that we live in.
Thank you for that, Rachel. And I do want to note that in the package that President-elect Joe Biden announced last night, the $1.9 trillion package that he announced, one of the things that it advances is paid COVID time off for people so that they can not go to work when they are sick or potentially sick. And I'm sorry to hear that your husband's colleague didn't inform him. Richard, contact tracing is something that the state was very excited about in the spring, spent a lot of resources on, really touted as a potential game changer. And it just has not worked well. We've seen challenges in terms of cooperation. It's very hard to track down where this spread is coming from if it's happening in private venues. Is there something we could have or should have done better there?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that the state probably in Massachusetts, I do know that we've probably been a little more aggressive with that than other states. But yet, as you said, the results haven't been that good. So, I think people need to remember that what we're going through is totally unprecedented. And, you know, I hope when this is all over that some of our policymakers will really look, you know, do a really deep dive as to what worked and what didn't in the situation. It seems to me like, as of this moment, the biggest problem we have right now is that we have this huge demand, you know, for this, for the vaccine, but yet, you know, the supply is limited. And whenever you have demand outpacing the supply, you're going to end up having issues. And ultimately, we can work on the distribution network, you know, to make it as quick as possible, but we need to have the vaccines manufactured, you know, to make sure that we have an ample supply to do it as quick as we can. And that's, I think, what we're going to be looking at the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks.
You know, I saw a report that was being reported by the Boston Globe today that the Trump administration had said that it was going to release additional vaccines that it had held in reserve, but then it turned out those had already been released. Mm-hmm. And so cities and towns that thought that there was a big wave of additional vaccines coming are now finding out they aren't, because what was being shipped before was coming straight off the manufacturing lines. Winnelia, it's hard at the state level, at the local level, to have any control over that. What levers should we and can we be controlling here in the Commonwealth? I want to point out, you know, WBUR's latest numbers have well over 300,000 doses delivered of the vaccine here to the Commonwealth. More than 200,000 people have received a first shot, but only 33,000 have received a second shot. So what are the levers we need to be pushing on as hard as we can?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's difficult for all the reasons that we've said, but I think that with the available supply that we do have, right, we do need to start beginning to have those engagement conversations for when the vaccine supply does get ready. We just can't wait until the vaccine is here for us to be having the kind of conversations in communities and across different constituencies so that we can increase the trust in the general public in Massachusetts to actually take this vaccination when it does arrive. And I think there also needs to be very particular kind of outreach within the healthcare force itself. We already know from other parts of the country that there's a high percentage of frontline workers and healthcare workers in particular that are opting out of this vaccine. So I do think there's a lot of trust building work that needs to happen at an institutional level for a lot of our healthcare core. But in addition to that, more broadly speaking, you know, for our general public as well. And I think that we really need to take into consideration what that means. And I also wanted to say, very simply put, a lot of the local levers that we do have in our capacity in Massachusetts, we're doing the best that we can, whether you're at a municipal level or whether you are at a statewide level. I think we're doing exactly what we can with what the resources that we do have. You know, many would say that there's always more that we can do, but I do think that given the federal debacle that's created, this has also made it more difficult for all of us. But I do think that we need to start being more honest about what it's really going to take to get ourselves out of this current situation. And most importantly, how do we start building the system so that we're ready for the next public health crisis and not assume that these kinds of things are not going to happen again.
Let's grab one more call on this. I won't put the number out because I think this will be our last call on this subject. We've got Patty on the line in Gloucester. Patty, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I think it's very important to discuss the vaccine and encourage the taking of it. But I also think it's very important in terms of controlling the epidemic or the pandemic, to encourage people to wear masks and socially distance. And I haven't heard that addressed in this conversation.
Thanks for that, Patty. And, you know, we had an Ask the Doctor segment earlier this week where both of the physicians that we spoke with underscored that, especially because there's still parts of the vaccination efficacy that we don't know. I want to play a little bit of sound from Dr. Joshua Barocas. He's an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center, and we were talking with him about what we know for sure about the efficacy of the vaccines. Here he is.
These vaccines are effective up to 3 months. And it's only because we don't have data beyond that point yet. Those trials are ongoing. But for right now, we know for certain, just based on the data, that it's that we have that immunity, that protection for 3 months.
Now, he went on to say that hopefully as we continue to measure, we will find that efficacy goes much further. And he did remind us that we don't know 100% whether you are still capable of shedding virus to someone else once you've been vaccinated. So all of those things to underscore what Patty was saying. We are going to shift gears now to the mayor's race, but I do just want to say quickly, before the break, we were talking about the coronavirus, and for our faithful listeners, some of you were expecting that Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, was to join us today, and he was. But his office asked this morning to reschedule because something important had come up for him. And we do understand he's a very busy man. He will be joining us at the end of the month, and we will keep you posted as to when that is. So just wanted to make sure to remind listeners of that. I know some of you were looking for him. Let's shift gears now. Mayor Marty Walsh delivered his final State of the City address. Let's think about his legacy as mayor as he prepares to go to Washington and head the Labor Department for President-elect Joe Biden, and the race that is coming for a new mayor. What do we need for a safe transition as we get at least one new mayor during this pandemic? Do we need a change in the type of leadership here in the city? What do you think Mayor Walsh's legacy is? And do you still feel Boston strong? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Richard Wilnelia, Mayor Walsh gave a State of the City address on Tuesday. It felt like a farewell speech to me. What struck you about it, Wilnelia?
You know, to use the words of some of the folks in the ecosystem that I've seen, it felt like a love letter to the city of Boston, you know, from one of Boston's own. And, you know, and I think that that's the tone exactly that he took. You know, I think that over the course of his administration, he bridged the gap between what some, you know, feels like a far framework these days, but he navigated the new and the old Boston and tried to deliver on many accounts. You know, some would say that he's fallen fallen short in certain areas around, you know, education. But I do think that he's done a lot to bring the city forward over the course of the last couple of terms. And I think most importantly, it's time for the city to really have a, you know, citywide debate about what it means, you know, for our future, not just in terms of how do we get through COVID safely in this next year, a couple of years, but the mayor's race really opens up a lot more seats in terms of what the future of the city looks like as well, not just at the mayor's level, but also at the overall municipal government level, and what that also means for the city moving forward. And although the mayor has been able to oversee an era of prosperity, generally speaking, you know, there's a lot of people in the city that have not benefited from that. And I think it's a time for that conversation to really happen more openly. It's not a stain on his legacy necessarily. I think every mayor does what they can in terms of moving the dial forward. And I think he did in many ways, especially at the cabinet level and at the sort of social determinants of health level. But I think we shall see soon really what it's all about in terms of the candidates and including soon to be Mayor Kim Janey.
So there's a lot there. I want to pick up first, Wilnelia, on your comment about the love letter. Richard, I'm going to play some sound for you here. And just for listeners, the state of the city was different this year. He, you know, delivered it from the new library in Roxbury, but he was alone. It was on. It was virtual. Here he is. And Richard, he gets choked up about his feelings for the city.
I believe in Boston. This is the city that welcomed my immigrant parents. This is the city that picked me up when I needed second chances. This is the city where I fought side by side with you for marriage equality, immigrant rights, addiction treatment, criminal justice reform, education funding, and good middle class jobs.
So there he is, both loving the city, as Wilnelia said, but also addressing key issues for the city: immigrant rights, addiction treatment, criminal justice reform. Wilnelia had a lot to say about where he may have fallen short as well, or where we need to do more. What's the agenda for the next mayor in your mind, Richard? Richard, do this I still have you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm here. Okay. You know, I didn't know who you were going to call on with being remote here. But I do think it's great to see him go out on top and, you know, and I think that there has been a lot of development that's taken place in the city. The city, you know, we're really at a point right now where the, you know, local residents and the local officials really have to decide what Boston's going to look like over the next decade. The amount of development that took place, you know, has helped reshape the city, but it's also created a lot of challenges. And then there's this whole transformation that's taken place, you know, the city that, you know, the mayor was elected to years ago is totally different than it is right now. It's changed as far as the diversity and, you know, within it. So there are going to be like a lot of challenges. I just think it's great to tip the cap to him. I think, you know, people really look at the job that he did, and I think that most would agree that he was a steady hand at a time. He was the right mayor the right time in Boston.
800-423-8255 to join this conversation. We've got Ed on the line from Rockport. Ed, what's on your mind?
Well, as I said to the person who took the call in, I watched the other night that almost two-hour, maybe more, piece on City Hall, and with a large part of it about the mayor, and it gave me a whole different view of him. I live in Roxbury, so I'm in Rockport, so I'm not part of Boston. But it was a real eye-opener, and it gave me a lot of hope. I think it's going to be Boston's loss and Washington's federal government's gain, and hopefully
Labor's
gain.
Thanks for that, Ed. So that is referring to a documentary, I think it's actually 4 hours long, that premiered on PBS last month, looking in depth at the operations at City Hall, largely under Mayor Marty Walsh's leadership. So Wilnelia Rivera, Ed is saying he thinks Boston's loss, Washington's gain. At the same time, we have what already is sizing up to be the most diverse candidate base for the race for mayor. Well, maybe that's an overstatement. We had a lot of people run in 2013, but it is a very diverse candidate pool. And right now, the only two officially stated candidates are women of color. And when Boston City Council President Kim Janey, who you referred to, becomes acting mayor, if Marty Walsh is confirmed, she'll be the first person of color and the first woman to be mayor. This is huge change coming.
Yeah. And it's and what I would say, it's about 20 years worth of work by a lot of different people across the city and across the state, in some cases across this country, because you don't get to this place in the electorate and in the history of the city by doing this alone. And obviously, every single resident in this community has also been a part of that. And I think also, most importantly, what the electorate has shown in the last several cycles citywide is that it's ready, and it has elected women of color to citywide seats, something even larger seats, but it's still going to be a competitive race. You know, as someone that was involved in the 2013 cycle, I was deputy campaign manager with John Barrows at the time. You know, endorsements can mean a lot of things, but it doesn't mean you win at the end of the day, you know? And I think that this is the kind of race that it's, you know, really pay attention to who's running. We won't know fully who the whole cast of characters are going to be probably till about 2 more months from now. But I think for a city that's been waiting for this long to have this kind of race, again, you know, 2013 and 2020, I think are very, you know, excuse me, 2021, forget that we've crossed over into a new year.
2020 honestly, keeps sucking like us back.
I tell other people all the time, it feels like quarter five these days. But the truth is for listeners, and especially for voters in the city of Boston, take the time to make your own decisions about whether or not, you know, who best represents the future of what you think the city can be. But someone that sits at the intersection of, you know, people, planning, and politics, I'm really excited to see the possibility of this electorate electing a woman of color to lead the city of Boston at this time and into the future.
You mentioned endorsements there. Richard, jump in.
I was going to say, this is going to be an interesting race because you don't have open seats that come available very often. I think for Boston, this is only the second time that this has happened in 28 years. And nobody's going to have the edge. You're going to see a huge field. I think there were 12 last time. And, you know, it's I know that there are favorites at the moment, but really what it's all going to boil down to at the end is who is in the race and how does the vote get split up among the people who are in the race. If you remember back in 2013, the two who made it to the final each got less than 20% of the vote. So, you know, the more people in, the more it gets split up, and anything could happen as far as, you know, as far as making it through the preliminary to the final. It's going to be exciting to watch.
Yeah, just to remind listeners, so we had an open seat in 2013, and I think it was 1993 when Boston Mayor Raymond Flynn became a potential ambassador to the Vatican, which eventually he did get appointed to. That was when then a city councilor, Tom Menino, became acting mayor, and then in an open race took the mayor's seat and obviously held it for a long time. It was he who left it and left it open in 2013. Well, Nelia, you talked about endorsements a minute ago. We've seen a bunch pour in, especially since it became clear that Joe Biden was going to name Marty Walsh as his labor secretary. For example, Michelle Wu, who was in the race, fully declared, has announced endorsements from the Sunrise Movement, from Senator Elizabeth Warren. Andrea Campbell has produced lists of endorsements, including people like State Rep Liz Miranda. I want to ask the two of you, have either of you endorsed a candidate at this point, or are you intending to? Well, Nelia, how about you?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would say is that I am personally supporting somebody. I'm personally supporting Michelle Wu, and I have been for a few months now. And the reason I want to differentiate for listeners, and I think this is important, again, especially for folks that are voters in the Boston electorate, is that you're going to have a lot of endorsements come through. Right. And the truth is that not everybody represents a political party or your own interests. So the important thing is that regardless of like what most recent announcement you hear, that you're making your own decision in terms of how this impacts yourself, your future, and your own family. And not just that, and not just your own family, but how does it impact the tapestry of what we're becoming as a city? Right. You know, while we've seen this city grow dramatically in the last 10 years, and we've seen the pain and also the recovery that we're trying to get to this year, there's also an opportunity for us to really dig deeper, to look at our past and think about what does it mean for our future in the terms of where we are now and what candidate best lines up with your values, and make that choice. Because unlike 93, or unlike other cycles where you know where we don't have a real open race, this is a real open race. So what I would say is pay attention to what folks are doing. You know, endorsements aren't everything, especially in this environment. And one of the things that Richard say that it's really important for listeners to hear is that between now and when we know who the whole field is, it's almost impossible to know really what the importance of any of these endorsements are. You know, I think for Andrea mm-hmm. and Michelle, they're going to have to continue their races as is until they know who else is in the race. But again, for voters in Massachusetts, pay attention to yourself and your own values and that of your neighbors.
So a lot of wisdom there from Will Nellie. Richard, how about you? Is this a race where you are thinking about endorsing or will endorse? And what other advice do you have?
I'm sitting out here in Wakefield watching what's going on in the big city. But, you know, I got to say, looking at all, you know, just from what I see, I think the police commissioner, if he were to jump in, would be a very interesting candidate.
William Gross.
Yeah, it's just, it's different. He's not a politician. I kind of have my eye on him, but it's, you know, there's a lot of people, and I agree, you're just not going to know what's going to happen.
Yeah, there was a point at which it looked like both Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins and Boston Police Commissioner William Gross were considering. Tompkins, it appears, has signaled that he will not enter the race. Mm-hmm. Gross has signaled that he's very close to entering. Well, Nelia, where's his support? I noticed, where would his base be? And I want to throw in a comment that Monica Cannon Grant, who's an activist and an organizer in the city, made earlier this week to Commonwealth, saying she felt that he should read the room about his candidacy.
Well, to expand on Monica's words, if I may, I don't want to put words in Monica's mouth, but I think I may understand what she means by that, is that, William Gross, even though he may not be a traditional politician, as some would think, as others are, like a Michelle Wuhr or an Andrea, he's still a political figure in the city by nature of the role that he's played in the Boston Police Department. And the truth is that his current tenure has been a very divisive one, especially in particular neighborhoods across the city. I do not work on that kind of advocacy work in terms of what those specific critiques and gripes are, but I know from the electoral perspective, he's going to have a really tough road up ahead. And I'm not clear on whether or not he even has residence in the actual city right now or not. I know that's been part of what
he does not.
So I think that's another factor. But I do think being part of the Boston Police means that puts you, that is a popular vote in the city somewhere. When you think about, parts of West Roxbury, Hyde Park, South Boston, it's not that he wouldn't have an electorate there for him. But I do think that he needs to figure out exactly whether or not this is the right run for him or not. First of all, not living in the city is one of it. And second of all, I think for a lot of the youth violence advocates and folks of the like, he's a very divisive figure.
We're going to turn now to Washington. A historic second presidential impeachment sparked by a violent insurrection at the Capitol just days before a new administration's inauguration. Listeners, yesterday you blew up our phones on questions of impeachment versus unity. If you have thoughts on that trade-off still, on whether the congressional delegation here in the Commonwealth is doing the right thing as they all support removal of the president? That's the accountability question. Call in with your thoughts. And do you feel safe here at home right now with events unfolding? Will you feel safe next week? How about the resilience of the state GOP? Call us on all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. All right. Wow. So much. I really want to keep it kind of locally focused. So Winnelia, Richard, I want to start with our congressional delegation. We have covered a lot with them over the last week and a half. And I'm thinking about a conversation we had yesterday with Congressman Seth Moulton that spanned from his call for accountability to the need for political and moral courage. Where are we on the question of political courage? I know it's a broad question, but I want to kind of give you room to move with it. Richard, to say.
Well, I think whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I mean, obviously, let me just say what happened was terrible. I couldn't sleep at night, having watched it. And everybody who was involved with it should be tracked down and arrested. I mean, there's just no question about it. Bigger picture wise, I have to say that, like, as a country, I'm really afraid of where we are right now. I can't believe that this is our country. And I think what, when I look at it, I see really both sides that have been playing, you know, with fire, basically, when it comes to delegitimizing elections. And now, because of what's happened over the last 4 years, and now, you know, we're really on a slippery slope. And, you know, I don't, you know, I think people really have to come together and just have that moment where they say, you know what, we can't do this as a country anymore. And I listened to Seth Moulton yesterday, you know, but when it comes to, you know, but the role that he's played and some of our congressional leaders have played hasn't been helpful. I mean, he, you know, just 4 years ago, he skipped the inauguration, you know, along with 68 other representatives, you know, as part of the resist movement, you know, saying that the election wasn't legitimate, and that, you know, and we went through that for 4 years. So here we go. This is the natural extension of what happened last week. I'm worried about what's going to happen 4 years down the road. So I really wish that, you know, Democrats and Republicans could, we do it really good here in Massachusetts. I'm not afraid of anything in Massachusetts because Democrats and Republicans work really well. The legislature is a shining example of how democracy is supposed to work. And I don't understand why people can't put the country first and just and come out with a united front and say there's no place for violence, you know, in our political system in the United States, period.
There's a lot there, so we'll know. Let me let you just jump in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think the unfortunate part is that there is too much space for violence in our country's history, you know? And I think it's important for us to think about this beyond the four-year cycles and really contextualize what happened, not just this past week, but what's happened the last 10 years, the last 20 years, whatever time span you want to put on it. The multiple crises we're living through is always connected to the same thing. We have deep, dark truths in this country that are connected to our past, to in terms of our founding, all the way to the present, right? That we had an all-Black delegation in the Reconstruction South, and that's not mainstream history, and people want to say that the South is rising again, that's part of the problem, right? So we can point to Democrats doing one thing, we can point to Republicans doing another, but the tribalism that now has replaced and become the norm in our politics and in our civic community has basically made it so that it's pretty difficult to solve simple problems. Look at the debacle that COVID has created, right? That we can actually see the impact of it. And I think we need to stop the oversimplification of what we're living through and try to think that it's going to happen over just one administration. This has to be an intergenerational all hands on deck moment. The tapestry of who we are as a country is literally unraveling, and we're not going to just be able to code it over, right? Our systems of governance can't hold either party accountable, and I want to be clear about that. Our systems of governance cannot hold either party accountable, right? And what does that mean for our private sector? It means that we have to leave it to their own benevolence to care, right? Why is it that now companies are saying they can't be with Trump, but just 2 months ago, it was fine? Right? We've got to stop chasing power in this country, and we got to have the fundamental conversations around who has it, who doesn't get it, and that right now we're just having the same conversation over and over again. And we need to come to the table, not as Republicans, not as Democrats, but as Americans. And what are the values that are actually going to tie us together so that we can get to a place where we can legislate again and lead again? Because the truth is that if we just see a Republican Party become a minority menace, we know that the Republican Party has the power, even in a minority technically, to stop the Democrats from effectively legislating. And I know I'm taking up a lot of space here, but I think it's an important warning that this word of unity, we are united. The Republic technically brings us together. What we need to figure out is actually what moves us. And it's not as simple as Democrat or Republican. We need to understand what's really underneath the hood there and what's the anxiety that, quote unquote, some people are experiencing, and what are the decades of inequities that others are, and how can we speak to both of those without dividing them one against the other or saying that somebody's humanity is more important than the other, when in fact we're a multiracial country and we need to start accepting that and leading like we are.
I think you and I should get together in a room and we'll figure out the whole thing.
It's been a while.
It's interesting. And so really, I'm glad you joked there, Richard, because in listening to the two of you, I thought two things. One, there's work that can be done. I mean, what you two are modeling, and it's part of what's interesting about experiencing this in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, that there is work that can be done. The other thing is that it would take me 7 hours to unpack everything the two of you just said, and I would like that 7 hours. No. I loved it, both of you.
What I like, but I do.
Go ahead, and then we'll get some caller voices in.
What I like, what was just said, was the fact that you have to understand where the other side is coming from, and I think, we spent a lot of time examining over the summer why there was so much social unrest and riots. You know, there was a lot of thought put into, what's the cause of that? And certainly everybody recognized that the Black Lives Matter movement was different than Antifa, that they were out there trying to create a problem, and agitate. In this case, I think it's important to do the same thing and to recognize that there are 74 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump that have, have their grievances, and we need to understand where they're coming from, and we shouldn't cleanse them. I've heard some things talked about that are really scary, and we shouldn't be looking to eliminate them or put them in education camps, as Robert Reich said. We should be trying to build a dialogue to get people on the same page, and I don't think it's that hard, but you can't be talking down to people. And the final thing I would say is you can't be shutting people off, because when you shut people off, through these bans in the social media, through the cancel culture, you're gonna just ferment even more of a problem, and it's gonna spiral out of control. We have to talk through our problems and not be afraid to do that.
Okay, again, so much there that I'm sure we could go back and forth on a lot more, but the phones have been exploded since we started this segment. We only have a couple minutes left, and rather than go back and forth more, I just want to pull a couple voices into this from the calls, too. So let's just grab a couple to kind of help us wrap up here. Let's go with William in Dorchester. William, be brief, please, and go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. And what I wanted to say is what we're experiencing in historically what has happened in our nation is how whiteness always finds a way to center itself in the narrative and proclaim the
narrative. William, did you say whiteness? Excuse me for interrupting. William, wait, excuse me for interrupting. Just to make sure people understood, whiteness. Did you say whiteness?
I said whiteness. As how
okay, please go ahead.
The narrative of our nation. So how important is now that we hear this call for unity is like claiming that for people of color in this nation, we never have a legitimate right to protest. And I identify as a Latinx person and an immigrant who have gone through many different things to call myself a citizen of this nation and to claim that place. So we need to really think about what is it that unifies us, but also what makes us part of this nation without having one single norm determine what the story and the voice of our nation is.
William, thank you for that call. I'll try to take one more here. We've got Bill and Drakett. Bill, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a 60-year-old white professional guy, basically very traditional conservative in my value system. Many times I consider I should be an R, but I can't be because Mr. Trump's conduct has been so outrageous, not only the past month or two, but since the beginning, and the people who support him, et cetera. So, I say I should be an R, and I can't be.
R being Republican. All right. Thank you so much for that call, Bill. I appreciate it. So listen, folks, we are a couple of minutes left in the show. It's been a heavy week. I do want to leave us time to get to hubbubs, which we're going to do in a second. I want to just on this subject as we wrap it up, there's so much more we could talk about. And my antenna are up that Wilnelia, you and Richard, you would be great people to continue to talk to about this. So I want to thank you both for the way you engaged there. And I wish, like I said, we had 7 hours more to do more on it. It has been a heavy week. I do want to leave a little time here to end with hubbubs, which are those local stories or events that caught our attention. Well, Nelia, did you bring one for us? And if so, what you got?
mean, I couldn't really think of a good one. It's been such a heavy week, but I did think of one as a Celtics fan, which I think is always a good hubbub.
Good.
Anyway, right? So
what is it?
You know, a lot of people were unhappy when we saw Kyrie Irving leave over to the Nets. Who's unhappy these days? Just want to say that.
Maybe I'll get Chris Siderick back on next week and we'll explain that further in a Check the Score segment. Richard, how about you? I think you brought us a hubbub today. What is it?
Yeah, so you know what? Our restaurants really need help right now. And just coincidentally, on Drew Barrymore's show recently, they had a contest, the best chowder in Boston. There are a number of different entries, Legal Seafoods, Yankee Lobster Company, Boston Sail Loft. It ended up that Legal Seafoods won, and today, if you have time, you can swing down to any Legal Seafoods. They are selling chowder for $1, and all the proceeds that they are receiving, they're earmarking for the Boston Children's Hospital.
Fantastic. And if you haven't had Legal Seafoods chowder, maybe now would be a good time to do that. Okay, so I have one for us too, and I confess that I mostly picked this hubbub because I wanted to flex my dinosaur name skills. When my son was little, he was obsessed with dinosaurs, and he made me learn all these names like Ornithomimus and Quetzalcoatlus. Mostly I just wanted to show off that I could say those, but this is kind of fun. So State Representative Jack Lewis of the 7th Middlesex is going to put forward legislation naming a state dinosaur, and it's been part of a plan to try to get kids interested in the legislative process. So he was supposed to put that forward today, but he created a contest. He had two nominees. I'll tell you about them in a second. You could vote for your favorite state dinosaur, and he got 30,000 votes so far. So he has extended the submission date to January 29th. We'll have a link to the ballot on our website. So you can pick either between Podocasaurus holiokensis or what I believe is pronounced Ankosaurus polyzelus. Those both roamed our region at one point, and if nothing else, I think it would be really fun to try to debate that in your household and say those three or four times. Richard Wilnelio, were either of you ever dinosaur fans at any point in your lives?
Yes, I went through that phase.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like almost every kid does in some capacity. Definitely did.
Exactly. So again, we'll have a link to that at our website, radioboston.org. There'll be hopefully some Celtics games again to watch soon. And this is a chance to try some Legal Seafoods chowder. We've had Wilnelio Rivera, a Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting. She was chief strategist for Representative Ayanna Pressley's successful 2018 congressional campaign. And Richard Tessay, a former Republican leader of the Massachusetts State Senate and a former Republican candidate for Congress. It was great to have you both. Thanks for leaning in and engaging today and being on the show.
Thank you
for your time.
Sure.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. We have an executive producer named Hitesh Hathi and a host named Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening and calling in. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.